over the years, talking with different people, watching people, reading books, I think that we would all understand and be able to admit that selfishness is a tremendous part of the human race. And I've wrestled for years with why that is, and I've finally kind of come to the conclusion that it's based on how God created us as we came out of the womb. When we came out of the womb, we had no ability whatsoever to have any care, consideration, or interest in anyone else's needs but our own. And if a lot of work isn't done while we're growing up, we never get past that. All of us were incredibly selfish because the only way that we could make our needs known was essentially to what we might call throw a tantrum, to wail, to cry, to inconvenience everybody around us, and very disruptive. And yet, because that's how God created children, we all understand. We don't try to discipline them. When they're in their infancy, up to about one and maybe even beyond, we don't discipline them for crying. We don't discipline them for waking us up in the middle of the night. We don't discipline them because that's how God created. And we all started with that. It's hard to realize that once Virgil was a little baby squalling in his mother's arm, but he was. So was I, so was all of you. And many of us had good parents who helped us to get out of that situation, but we didn't want to. Sometimes children don't want to stop being inconsiderate. They like being selfish. They like being the center of attention. They don't want to be second, but that's part of the foolishness that's in the heart of the child. When God wrote that, I know that this was definitely a part of what he was describing. Because when children are born, they act very foolishly because that's how God has, I don't know if you want to use the word program or if you want to use the word, this is how God created them to respond. But no child ever comes into the world unselfish. And we didn't come into the world unselfish. And so the foolishness that was bound up in my heart and bound up in your heart had to be driven out. And the farther away they drove with this selfishness, the more we should thank them today. The more we should appreciate what they've done. When my children were young, I realized they wouldn't remember anything past about the age of 5. I can remember, I think, one event before the age of 5. And most of you, maybe you can go back a little further, but very few of us could go back before the age of 3. So if we do most of our heavy training with our children before the age of 3, we teach them not to be selfish, not to cry, not to act like they were acting throughout that time, and giving them the opportunity to start school with a tremendous lead over those who didn't get that training. And so, wise parents are training their children to be considerate of other people's needs. The terms please and thank you and I'm sorry have become a little bit archaic in our culture. I think that's really sad, because I think those three words were designed to help each one of us appreciate consideration for other people. Nobody's obligated to give me something. When I say, please pass the salt, it's because I recognize that they don't have to do it. It's a personal favor to me to do it. And that's why I want to say thank you, to show appreciation for the favor. Now, that's training us. That's why I think those words are so important. It's training us to understand. Now, they can be just words. Some people say please and they don't have any care or concern whatsoever that they're inconveniencing someone or that someone is doing something for them that they didn't have to do. But if wise parents are training their children properly, these become tools to help us become more considerate to other people. And that's why I think that this is so important. I think I'm sorry expresses our genuine regret that we had to inconvenience somebody. We put somebody out or we made somebody unhappy. And we're sorry for that. And we want to express that sorrow. I don't know if you want to call it a confession, but it is part of becoming and having a servant mentality. If we go through life, they've coined a new word in our culture today. We didn't use this when I was a kid. I don't know that it existed back then. But narcissism essentially means I can't see anyone else's needs but my own. I don't even consider your sorrow. I don't even understand what that is. And I don't care what it is because I can't even understand what it might be. You exist to serve me. You exist to fulfill my needs. And if that puts you out, well, that and that's the infant mentality as it moves into the adulthood. And so these three words, please, thank you, and I'm sorry, are good training. Now, I'm not saying you have to teach these things or you have to use these things, but you have to have the emotions. When you ask people for things, you need to express it as a favor. It's not demanded. They don't have an obligation to serve me. And if I consider myself, the way Jesus said, as last of all and servant of all, then you doing something for me is something I want to thank you for and something I want to plead with you to do. And so the goal is to be as considerate of other people. And maybe one step behind that, realizing that other people have needs. Realizing that other people have feelings. I think that as we look out into the world today, we see people who have no care whatsoever for the people that they're ruling or the people that they are making decisions for. They use their power only for themselves. And I think we've seen a lot of that in the last few years, in the last few decades, of people who are more interested in what we can do for them than in what they can do for us. But this is the essence. This is something I'd never noted before, but I think it's really important. So let's go ahead and think a little bit about this. Whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. That's what we're trying to teach our children, to be considerate, to understand that what you're asking them to do for you shouldn't be any more than you would want done for you. And why is this called the golden rule? Because this is the law and the prophets. This one verse. Remember, Jesus was asked later in Matthew chapter 22. What's the greatest commandment in the law? And he said there's two. The first one, you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The second one, you will love your neighbor as yourself. Upon these two laws hang both the law and the prophets. Well, Jesus does essentially the same thing here. He said if you could boil down the entire Old Testament law, every command from Genesis to Malachi, everything in the old law that was written, you could summarize it with this one statement. All things or whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. Now, golden rule is not in the scriptures, and I've always been a little bit shy of using the term because I don't really like using human terms for something that God has given to us. But under these circumstances, I wanted to use it in the sense of this is how we should be training our children. We should be training our children to always live the golden rule. To always do what they would want other people to do for them. That's how we train people, that other people have feelings. They feel just like me. And if I snatch something from them, well, I know how I'd feel if they took it from me. Oh, I guess I shouldn't do that. But children can't always reason like that. Children can't always reason, but adults should be able to reason like that. If I wouldn't want someone yelling at me because I made a mistake on the road, then maybe I shouldn't be yelling at them because they made a mistake on the road. The term gar, as we've talked about so many times in the past, is the reason and the cause of a previous statement. So the reason and the cause for the statement, all things that you want men to do to you, is because that's the essence of the law and the prophets. So the foundation of all godliness and spiritual maturity is going to be based on what our parents did for us in our formative years. Like I said, some kids, you see them in the store all the time. They don't get what they want, they throw a fit. They yell, they scream, they start hitting their mother. You think to yourself, what kind of people are these people going to turn out to be? Because no one is training them that that's not how you act as you move into an adult. We're created in the image and likeness of God. The infancy of man is a temporary situation, and the what we might call the scaffolding of infancy is wailing and crying and throwing a fit to get your way or get your needs fulfilled. But we have to put away childish things. Paul said, when I was a child, I thought as a child, I acted as a child, but now that I become an adult, I've put away those things. And so when our children say please and thank you with feeling, and we can see that they truly care about the needs and feelings of others, we can feel confident we're moving them into the very purpose of the Old Testament scriptures, and of course the New Testament scriptures as well. So parents are doing their children a great service by training them up in the way they should go. I think we all appreciate that. I know I wish that my parents had done a better job at that, because then I wouldn't have as much to do. And maybe some of you feel the same way, where we have this selfishness. It's lurking in the hearts of all of us. In spite of their best interests, most of us still have a little of it. Some of us have a lot of it. We can mask it, but it's still there. We might do the things that we know the Lord wants us to do, but kind of like that guy in Proverbs where it says, when you're invited to a feast by a wealthy man, don't eat his dainties, even though he's encouraging you to do so, because his heart is not with you. He's pretending. He would get angry if you completely do what he's encouraging you to do, because he doesn't want you to do that. And so it's a big game. I want what's best for me, but in order to fit in with other people, I know how to act, to say please, to say thank you, to say I'm sorry, but we don't mean it. Now, I don't know how much of that we have in ourselves still, but I do know this. This is why the apostles couldn't understand what Jesus was trying to teach them, and this is why some of us can't understand it. We can't understand how giving everyone else what is the best would somehow make our lives better. This is more blessed to give than to receive. For many people, that's a foreign language. It's a heavenly language that some people don't understand. And so we need to finish what our parents started. And so what we have to try to figure out is whether we like this, whether we agree with this. Now, if we're still a child in heart, if we're still like we were when we were an infant, these passages make absolutely no sense, and they never will. You can read them, you can even explain them, but they don't make any sense, and you won't see any changes in your personal life. We will never do these things. We can teach them. We can explain them, but it'll never happen until we take the next step. So the question is our servant mentality a facade? I looked up the word facade today. It means the storefront, the front of the building. You may go through the front and it's a complete dump, but if the outside looks nice, this is the word facade would perfectly describe the Pharisees, who were on the outside like a beautiful tomb, but on the inside full of dead men's bones. Well, my service to other people. You know, as a preacher, I recognize I need to be a servant. You need to see me as a servant. Now, I may not be a servant at all. I may be a hypocrite. I may act like I'm a servant and not be one. And that's why when each one of us reads these verses, we have to see, is this really a part of what I really want? If anyone desires to be first, well, I think all of us would agree with that. That's what I want. But this last of all and servant of all, you know what that means? It means when you're sitting at the dinner table, you let everybody else take all the best, and then when they're finished, whatever's left over, you're going to take it. Can we act like that? Can we feel like that? When it's time for dessert, we let everybody else go, and they've already taken my favorite dessert, but in order for me to serve them, I'm willing to do that. Now, you might be thinking in your mind, these are ridiculous illustrations. No, they're not, because they're illustrative of what goes on in every other realm of our life. If we can't even do it with food or dessert or with other activities, how are we ever going to do it with our money, with our time, and with our personal pride and dignity, which is very important to these selfish people? Whoever desires to be great among you shall be your servant. And whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. I think we understand the verse up here. But how about in here? How many of us can actually say, this is my ethic. This is how my parents raised me. This is how I've been training myself. The golden rule is the rule that I live by, and I will not ever do anything that would take something that somebody else ought to have because I want it more. So we need to test ourselves. In my heart of hearts, where only I know, do I exist to serve others? Or do others exist to serve me? Now, your wife and your husband could probably answer that question, because through the years, they've watched how you respond and how you act, and they know whether your feelings are important to them or whether they're not. Whether they are more interested in you being happy, every decision they make, they consult and they talk and they discuss so that whatever is best is given to the other party. Now, if we go through life, and of course, if you're a husband, you could do this. You make every decision, you force your wife to do everything you want to do, and then you tell me, well, I'm fulfilling this verse. No, you're not. Because when we get to Ephesians chapter 5, in a few weeks, we're going to find out that the husband is supposed to love his wife like Christ loved the church. Well, Christ loved the church to the degree where, as Jeff was pointing out this morning, he left heaven. He gave up the best to come to this earth to serve. Now, that is a service in leadership that Jesus wants to see in the church. So, if I don't say please, and again, I'm not saying you have to. I don't know that this is an absolute. It's not in the scriptures. But if you don't say please, is it because you're entitled? Because why should I say please? They should be doing that for me. I have a need. They exist to fulfill that need. Why should I say please? Why should I say thank you? They should have done it. Why should I appreciate it? Was expected, was demanded. So these are interesting questions. And again, what I'm trying to do, and the reason I'm doing this is because over the years I've watched how I've responded. I've preached this, I've seen it, I understand it. And then when I get through, some of the same selfish things come up again. And so I've tried to figure out, what is the problem here? Why is this one so hard? Why is this one so difficult for so many people? And again, I think we can all trace back to a couple of points. We made one in the last lesson we talked about last week, and the next one is in this lesson, and that is that as we were growing up, we learned that special abilities brought special benefits. We wanted them. Why couldn't we just be happy that they had it and just accept what we have? Well, that's not part of human nature. And certainly not part of how we grew up as infants. So Jesus makes it very clear that even though all infants enter the world as lords, and they do, they're lords, everything stops for me. And, as I said, many children grow on to become adults, and they like that mantra. They like that attitude. But we have to complete their duty in order to become great. You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them. And their great ones exercise authority over them. So we see at work. It's what we see on the playing field of all these professional sports. It's what we see in politics. It's what we see on the roads, lording it over. their great ones exercise authority over them, just like an infant. Why? Because that's natural. It's normal. It's how we started out. And if nobody taught us the heavenly language of service, we'll never learn it. People in the world, they have lost their divine nature, their divine image. They are no longer in the image and likeness of God. And they will not, they don't want to become partakers of the divine nature. So they stay like Gentiles. Verse 43, but it shall not be so among you. Whoever desires to be great among you shall be your servant. And whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all or last of all. That's why I say when you're at the potluck and you make yourself go last, I'm saying you always have to do that, but if you do it with the attitude of these people deserve to have the best, then that's why we're doing it. And it's a training exercise. Again, it's insignificant in some ways, but it's illustrative in other ways. It tells me a lot about myself. It tells me a lot about my priorities, and it tells me a lot about my selfishness. But this is a foreign language. It's a heavenly language. This is how it exists in heaven. It doesn't exist like that on earth. We don't see this in the world. But Jesus says, whoever desires to be great among you shall be your servant. And whoever desires to be first shall be slave of all. Now, I don't know how else to translate that. That means that I live to serve you. My needs are fulfilled when I fulfill your needs. But as I say, it is a foreign language. It was to the apostles. They never could get it while Jesus was alive. They finally got it after. But they didn't have it. They couldn't understand it. How can serving and being a servant be great? Well, Paul portrays the institution of the Lord's Supper as occurring on the very night or the same night in which he was betrayed. And we can read the end of the institution of the Lord's Supper when he said in verse 20, this is the new cup, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you. And then Jesus segued from the institution of the Lord's Supper into the betrayal. So he says, behold, the hand of my betrayer is with me on the table. So Judas is still there. And truly, the Son of Man goes, as it has been determined, but woe to that man by whom he is betrayed. Then they began to question among themselves which of them it was who would do this thing. Now there was also a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. Can you imagine what Jesus must have thought? To see them descending from who would betray the Lord to, I'm better than you. I'm greater than you. I have more value than you. I couldn't be the betrayer. You might be the betrayer because I'm better than you are. That's what was going on here. There was a dispute among them. How could they be thinking like this? So self-centered. Here's Jesus about to be crucified. Here's Jesus about to be betrayed by one of his own disciples, by one of his own apostles. What are the disciples talking about? Jesus dealt with this a little bit later in the evening when he said, you should be glad for me because I'm leaving. You shouldn't be sad for yourselves. You should be glad for me. But they couldn't think like that. And as Jesus points out, this is Gentile speaking. This is Gentile reasoning. This is Gentile language. They were still acting like Gentiles. Even the law of Moses would have brought them to a better destination than they were at. They were acting like the Gentiles. You know, Paul could speak the language of Jesus. I do not seek yours, but you. I'm last of all. I'm servant of all. You don't exist for me. I exist for you. I'm not after yours. I don't want your time. I don't want your money. I don't want your service. I don't want your respect. I don't need any of that. I only care about you. For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. This is another interesting way of describing this situation. That we should be looking at other people like parents look at their children and not the other way around. Here's what he said. I will very gladly spend and be spent for your souls. So the language of the heavenly that is spoken in the Lord's church is pretty well laid out by this. I would gladly spend and be spent for your souls. That's where we're traveling. That's the destination. If we want to be great in the kingdom of heaven, that's our destination. Now the question, and I've asked this last week as well, is do we want it if that's what it is? I mean, I want to be great. You want to be great. But generally speaking, we're looking at the fringe benefits of greatness. We like greatness because they get paid more, because they can tell other people what to do, because other people have to treat them with respect, because other people have to submit to them because they are in authority. But not so among us. We don't want the chief seats in the synagogues. We don't want to be called by men rabbi or father. We don't want to be served. We want to be servants. Now, that's the difference between the Lord's church and all the denominations and all the worldly governments and all the worldly businesses and all the worldly families. We exist for an entirely different purpose, as Paul could speak that language. And of course, so could the rest of the apostles not long after. Now, this is either a reminder or an introduction. I am among you as one who serves. Now, I don't know if that was the introduction to the foot washing, or if he had already done the foot washing and then washed as they descended into arguing, and he brings them up short by saying, I am in your midst as one who serves. And I've studied and studied. I've looked at different harmonies of the gospel, trying to place. Our problem is very simple. Judas is still at both. Judas is at the Lord's Supper. Judas is in the middle of is getting his feet washed. The apostles, the Lord's Supper is instituted during or after the completion of the supper. The foot washing also happened during the supper. So we don't know which happened first. So either as he watches his apostles act like Gentiles, he gets the towel and he washes their feet. Or he's already done it, and now that they're acting like Gentiles, he reminds them of it. During supper, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God. Now this sums up Philippians chapter 2. He was existing in the form of God and didn't count equality with God a thing to grasp. It also takes in John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. He knew he came from God. He knew he was part of the Godhead. He also knew that within a few weeks all authority would be given to him, that he would be reigning as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, not just over the earth, but in heaven. He had a dignity and a right to expect service beyond anything we could ever understand. But in verse 4, he got up from supper, laid aside his garments, taking a towel, he girded himself, then he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet. Now, the basin and the towel had been provided. He found them there. Well, what was missing? No servant. The servant was supposed to do this, but I read one guy and I thought he had an interesting point, although you could never prove it. This was an intimate gathering between Jesus and apostles, and whoever provided the room knew that it would be out of place to put a slave there. So he figured somebody would volunteer. If he had the towel and he had the water, it would get done. Well, Jesus waited until the supper had already started. They were already eating. There was no way anybody now was going to say, look, we need to wash each other's feet. I'm sure Jesus was deeply disappointed because he'd been training and training. And that's why I say, I don't know if this happened before or after. Some things tend to point to before and some things tend to point to after. But decades later, here's what John, he loved them to the end. John now saw this. He didn't see it at the time. As a matter of fact, Jesus told all of them, you don't understand what I'm doing right now. But you'll understand later. But John understood that the greater was performing the lowest act of service, and that's what we need to understand. That's the point here. None of us are too good. We're not too smart. We're not too good looking. We're not too charismatic. We're not too wealthy. There really is no human attribute that would lead any of us to be able to say, look, you need to wash my feet. I'm not about to wash your feet. They refused because of dignity, selfishness, and a desire for greatness. That's what this is all about. And that's why I say we need to look within ourselves. We were born with this. And we may still have it. We were born with it. We like to be lords. We like everyone else to take care of our needs. It's how we were born. It's how we were raised. It's what our parents tried to get out of us, but it's hard to get out. And that's why Jesus served them. For exactly the same reasons. To destroy their dignity, to remove their selfishness, and to show them the true destination of greatness. Peter's response is so simple. You don't have to know, like people like to go back, well, we need to study this foot washing. What was it about foot washing why was it? Well, all we have to look is Peter. Peter says, Lord, well, let me jump ahead to the next one. Lord, are you washing my feet? He's amazed. This is unheard of. He wouldn't do it. None of the rest of the apostles would do it. And they all know Jesus is greater than they are. It's incomprehensible. How can this be? Well, Jesus says, what I'm doing, you don't understand now. Like I said, it's a heavenly language. But you'll know. You'll learn. You'll learn. You can't understand. But as you remove selfishness from your heart, and that's why all of us need to be growing in this, so we can try to understand why Jesus did this. Peter is the lesser. Peter recognizes Jesus as the greater. In his world, this can't happen. Can't happen. The greater cannot be allowed to serve the lesser. I wouldn't do it. I do unto others as I would have others do unto me, and I would never wash these guys' feet. So what do you do? Why are you doing it? You will never, ever wash my feet. Now, Peter thought this was a compliment. He thought that this was the best way he had to show Jesus how much he loved him, how much he respected him, how great he knew that he was. Well, Jesus basically says, if you can't learn this, there's no room in the kingdom for you. If you don't let me wash your feet now, there's the door, Peter. We don't have a relationship anymore. You can't have any part with me whatsoever unless you let me wash your feet. But why was the Lord so adamant? Why was it that he wanted to wash his feet? Because he was trying to teach them a vital lesson. Peter is still firmly convinced greatness is based on selfishly taking, not unselfishly giving. That's why he wouldn't stoop so low as to wash his fellow apostles. That's why none of them would wash each other's feet. He saw it as a sign of weakness, a sign of servitude. Just like all infants and all Gentiles see it. That's why he refused. The key question here, as we quickly start winding down, do you know what I've done to you? Now, the obvious answer would be, yeah, Lord, you washed our feet. That's not what he wanted. The answer was based on, you call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. In other words, there is a pecking order in the kingdom of heaven. And the higher we go, the lower we put ourselves. The higher we go, the more service that we're willing to do. They knew his greatness. But he reminds them anyway, I'm the Lord and the teacher. And you ought to wash one another's feet. Now, this is principle, not a specific action. He's not instituting a foot washing here. He's instituting service. The greater serves the weaker. And that's what he's teaching here. He could not be clearer. I've given you an example that you should do as I have done, not what I have done, but as I have done to you. Most assuredly, amen, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. But multitudes still don't understand. And that's really the question of this lesson. Do we understand? And if we understand, how's it translating into our personal lives? How often are we serving other people? How often are we thinking about how we can serve other people? Or how often are we concerned about other people's needs? How often do we say please and thank you? Whether we say the words, how often do we convey please and thank you in the way we treat other people versus expectations they're going to do, they should be doing to me? You all are my slaves, so if I ask you to do something and you do it, why would I thank you and why would I say please? That's how an infant reasons. That's how the Gentiles reason. But that's not how we reason. Since Jesus was so considerate of man's needs that he left his glory in heaven to serve them, this foot washing is immaterial. This foot washing is a drop in the bucket compared to what he did when he left heaven to come to this earth to die for us. But it was a graphic illustration and one that John recorded for us to understand. So there's a two-step process here. First, and for most of us, the most difficult is to see and recognize and understand this truth to a degree where we can feel it every day as we meet different people, as we go into the grocery store, I'm a servant here. As we go and get into our car, I'm a servant here. As we enter the workplace, I'm a servant here. As we come home as a father or a mother or children, I'm a servant here. And the needs of whoever I am around are equally, if not more important than my own. That's what we should be growing into if we ever want to be great. We've seen that whatever you want men to do to you, do also unto them. And just as you want men to do to you, you do also to them likewise. That's the different rendition in Matthew, the first one, and Luke, the second one. This is the law and the prophets. This is what the entire Old Testament was designed to teach us. Have we learned it? This is what the foot washing was designed to teach us. This is what Christianity has been designed to lift us to. Everything we want to receive from others, we want to set aside. That's a battle. That's a lifelong battle. It's going to be difficult because it's not how we were born and it's not how a lot of us were raised. The more selfish we are as we enter the kingdom, the harder it's going to be for us to see it. But you know something? We're only blessed if we do it. We'd like to think to ourselves, well, if I can just see it, that's good enough. Alan, you've done a great job. I can see it. I can go home. I'm now among the great in the kingdom of heaven. No, we're not there yet. Seeing it, that's a huge step. I wouldn't disagree with that. It's hard to hold on to this. If we can actually get to where we see it all the time and start understanding it, and feeling guilty when we don't do it, that's a big step. And it's an important step. But greatness doesn't come until we do it. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. So this lesson is primarily designed just to get us to take a hard look at ourselves. We know how we were born and we know how we were in our youth. We know how much selfishness we had. We can look back on it now, maybe with regret and shame, but we can look back on how we didn't care about other people's needs. But now in our marriages and in our workplace and in our relationship with brethren, what are we seeing? Is it all about me? Do I exist for all of you to serve me? If I do, I'm a Gentile in my thinking. I'm an infant in my thinking. And I'm the lowest in the kingdom of heaven. So as we pick up our songbooks, I think we have an important question to ask ourselves. What do we need to do now? This is the greatest hurdle to becoming great in the kingdom of heaven. And it's interesting because when you look at agape love, and remember God is love, agape love is service. Agape love is putting other people's needs above our own. Agape love is being aware of what other people need and being ready to sacrifice to give it to them. That's how God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. We'll never be like God. We'll never recapture the divine nature, the divine image that we were stamped with when we were created. We're never going to recapture that until we start down this path. See it, and then make the decision to become more like it. As we now prepare to sing the song of encouragement, if there's anyone in the audience whose life or heart has been touched by this lesson, it feels like there's some changes that need to be made, if we can help you in any way, either by obedience to the gospel or by repenting of any sin that you might have committed, we invite you now to come while we together stand and sing.